and you may find yourself living in a shotgun shack. And you may say to yourself, this is not my regular podcast. This is not my regular co-host. Hi, this is the Two on One Project. I'm your co-host, the Reverend Arthur Stewart.
Your other co-host, Reverend Stephanie Kendall. And what an intro, Arthur.
I'm just so excited about David Byrne, Spiff.
I know you are. I know. Listen, when our guest today, we went through a couple iterations of like, what might their topic be? And you had said David Byrne, you talked about David Byrne in a couple episodes ago. And the minute he said that, I was just like, oh my goodness, this is the episode for Arthur.
This is. And it's also the episode for our guest, Micah, who is coming on shortly. How are you doing today?
I'm only sighing because, and our listeners who are listening to it, as we were getting on the show to get today, I was showing off my Jessa Decker Smith chalice. I go to put it down, and in real David Byrne fashion, I've got broken things out. And so I'm going to reach out to Jessa. There is something theological here about our brokenness and what holds us together and what is really at the table. So get ready for that meditation on Monday or on Sunday. But I'm okay. I'm just now holding something sad and beautiful.
Well, I'm holding something whole and complete. A lovely member of my congregation bought me a Jessa Decker Smith coffee mug that, for people who are listening, is black and it has a rainbow chalice on it and it is lovely. And I think my coffee tastes better in it. Speaking of marvelously crafted, handmade things that probably have chalices on them or can.
They can.
Can we talk about our sponsor for a second, Jeff Wonderow Designs?
We can, because as we were talking about Jessa's stuff, I was like, you know what? I'm really grateful for church people, people within faith communities that share their gifts so widely, and who know that creativity and art and like things like textiles and, you know, all of that, you know, pottery, all the different things are such beautiful gifts of the spirit. And Jeff Wonderow Designs utilizes his in such a way that is community building, is expansive, and is beautiful.
Well, for 17 years or so, they've been making ordinary time extraordinary.
Is he going to do a year every episode?
No, it was 15 when we started, and we've been, we went up to 16 at some point. I'm just calling it 17 and calling it good.
I'm here for it. Jeff forever.
Jeff forever. For 17 years, though, or 16 years, or actually, you know what? For a very long time, Jeff Wonderow Designs has been making ordinary time extraordinary by providing stoles, paraments, banners, chasuble bells, copes, and a variety of altar decoration and decor for congregations and clergy alike, across denominations, across the country, across the theological spectrum. You should go over to Jeff Wonderow, JeffWunrow.com, following today's show, and check out all of the marvelous and amazing products he has available, and also customization options for products that haven't been made yet, but can be.
I mean, he just does it all. And I'm just going to name it. Our deuces know that I have struggled to do the website well. I get tongue-tied, and you do it so well. And you do that list from memory. I'm impressed. I am impressed with the amount of things that Jeff does, and I'm impressed that you remember them, because I just spend a lot of time at 2 a.m. scrolling his website. So.
Well, and I'm glad you do that. You also have the benefit of having ordered a custom stole that you've received. I know, as we talk about like the use of things in ministry, I have my rainbow crane stole, and I haven't talked about it lately, but I love this stole, and I think I could wear it literally every time I do anything ministerially. My favorite story about it is that it is stained on the back because I wore it in Pride in Dallas, where it was 100 million degrees. And it is a sunscreen baptism on the back of this stole. And it's this beautiful, marvelous handmade stole that I have not ruined, but enhanced with, with my... Okay, I'm not going to...
That customization is not available online, but it is yours to do with your
Precisely. Soul. But I think the point I'm trying to make is this. These are paraments and banners and stoles and chasubles and copes that are made to enhance and inform our worship. And it is worship done by human beings. If you're going to have something that makes a theological statement, why not state it clearly and boldly that God is good and God enhances our lives with creativity and the good work like done by Jeff Wunrow Designs. Once again, Jeff Wunrow, JeffWunrow.com. Head over there today and do note, if you're listening to this in 2021, you only have a few weeks left. We have a promo code, 2-on-1, all one word, all letters, at checkout, 15% off your entire stole order. Does that include custom options, Spiff?
It does.
Does that include numerous stoles, Spiff?
It does.
Well, this is like a ridiculously good discount, and you should head over to JeffWunrow.com, JeffWunrow.com.
Now you're just showing up.
Still steal the show.
They do. Go over it. Listen, Christmas is coming. I don't want to name it for us, but it is on the horizon, friends.
It's always Advent or almost Advent here.
It is always, but you know, I haven't not bought some customized stoles for some people in my life from Jeff Wunrow for Christmas or for certain, you know, milestones in our lives. So
we want to gift the Magi each other and like send each other a stole this year for Christmas. Let's do that.
Okay.
Well, that being said, thank you, Jeff. And now let's talk about David Byrne. I'm going to bring in Micah.
Okay. I'm so excited.
I usually warn our guests that we're going to do it, but I'm just going to launch it.
Uh-oh.
Hey, I forgot to give you the 30-second warning, Micah, but welcome to...
Exciting. Here I am.
There you are. Sorry, that was a... Yeah, we went on a little bit longer and then all of a sudden we're like, we got to bring in Micah.
No problem. I am so excited to be here.
Well, all right. Thank you for coming. Yes. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, Micah, who are you? What do you do? And what books have you published recently?
Wow. Thank you so much for that invitation. My name is Micah. I am an ordained minister in the United Church of Christ, and I currently serve as the minister at Judson Memorial Church, where I right now am co-clergy with two other ministers. And I have just published a book called The Book of Tiny Prayer. Wow, Stephanie. Arthur, where's your copy?
I know, I don't have it.
Embarrassing for you.
I know. Thanks for putting it out for all of our listeners.
Well, first of all, I'm happy to send you one. Stephanie, thank you for having one. It's called The Book of Tiny Prayer, and it is a collection of very, very short prayers that I wrote and published on social media from March 24th of 2020 to March 24th of 2021, which I think all of us remember as a very scary time that we are still continuing to experience in a lot of different ways. So it's called The Book of Tiny Prayer, Daily Meditations from the Plague Year. And what I did was essentially... In that time, right as New York City went on lockdown, I found myself really needing a way to lean more into my prayer life and use it as a way of kind of dealing with the overwhelm of what I was seeing happening in the news and kind of bite off one thing each day that I could give attention, intention, time, and quiet to. And so I started to just wake up in the morning, walk my dog, Carl Thomas Dean. And during that time, I would write a little tiny prayer based on whatever was happening in my own heart or what I had just seen in the news. And then when I got home, I would post it. And what ended up happening was that this solitary practice then became a communal practice in a lot of ways because people started responding, both people that I would expect to, but then also people who were sort of like, prayers? What are prayers? Yes, Stephanie was definitely there. And then, but I think like it became this strange way of both talking about the prayers themselves, but then also talking about what is prayer anyway? In a society where the idea of prayer, the concept of thoughts and prayers has been either totally diluted or totally weaponized. And so magically, you know, I developed long COVID. I contracted COVID and was diagnosed at the very end of 2020. And then I'm still kind of suffering the effects of long COVID. And so on March 24th, 2021, I was having difficulty kind of keeping up with the practice. And so I had this thing happen where I thought, it's actually a spiritual practice in and of itself to decide when to stop doing a practice. And so I announced to the very small circle of people who were following these prayers. I basically said, like, thank you so much for praying with me for a year. I'm going to do it, you know, maybe periodically, but not daily anymore. And almost immediately I heard from an editor at Fordham University Press, Richard Morrison, who wrote, I've been following these prayers and I think they'd make a wonderful collection. So they rushed to get it out and it's out in the world and it's so cute and it fits in my hand. And I would like to believe it's a very authentic chronicle of what I was experiencing during that time. And I hope that it is nourishing and galvanizing to and for, you know, folks who encounter it now.
I don't think there's a way to overstate how different the experience of New York City is to the rest of the country in terms of pandemic. Because I was with a group of clergy, I remember that, and we were watching on somebody's phone when the hospital ships came in, that they were prepared to have be a morgue. And I remember the succinct prayer that one person said, which was just, oh, Jesus Christ. And then there was just silence. And it's the... I'm saying this for our deuces. That's what we lovingly call our audience. I'm saying this for our deuces who are not in New York City. Like it's a completely different bear. It's been a bear everywhere, but it's a completely different bear there. And thank you very much for your witness and your prayer work.
Absolutely. And I mean, I know that I'm talking to two pastors. So I also feel like while pointing out both the kind of unique experience of being in New York City, and then of course holding the unique experience of how marginalized communities were also, you know, exponentially affected in ways that, you know, rang true to the ways that they have been historically marginalized, but added a layer and more layers to their experience during that time. I also think that people in helping professions, and especially, you know, of course, first responders and also pastors, it was an experience that I think I know I need to unpack with fellow pastors probably for the rest of my life. And I think that writing these prayers also, because of course, you know, we were trying to keep, as you all were doing, as many pastors were doing, we were trying to keep the practice of Sunday morning worship and keeping a community together going, which was challenging enough. But I think that it was a reminder of how do you hold others' grief and fear when you are fearing and grieving yourself. And these little prayers that I started writing, I started to think of as confessional invitations to others, because, you know, a lot of times sometimes they're to specific people who have just died. Sometimes they're to inanimate objects. But a lot of times they are to, you know, folks who are grieving or folks who are feeling meh, or whatever. And oftentimes when I look back on that prayer, I'm like, oh, well, that was a prayer to myself and for myself at that time. And it was an invitation to not feel like as a faith leader, you're called to be a hero of faith and a model of unshakable faith, but that actually what you could be called to do is show your own vulnerability, show your own fear and grief, and invite others to be just as authentic and honest. So it was a practice of doing that as well, and not always trying to be just unshakable and viewed as, you know, unaffected, which I think, you know, a lot of times I know what I, as a faith leader, like feel like I've got to like buck up and look like these things are things that we can get through together. And I feel like we can still spread that word while being very honest about what's happening in front of our eyes.
the church can always benefit from more authenticity and honesty. So your book is called The Book of Tiny Prayers.
The Book of Tiny Prayer.
The Book of Tiny Prayer. Okay, make sure you get that correct, Deuces, when you search for it on any sort of bookseller that you can get online. And Micah, I appreciate the invitation, or the offer rather, to send me a copy, but I'm going to buy my own because I want to make sure that your book does really well and that volume two, whatever it may be, the Book of Minuscule Prayer, the Book of Slightly Larger Prayer, comes out and has a huge audience expected. So everyone should head over to bookshop.org if you want to avoid a big smiling rainforest of corporations and see what happens, or do it wherever you want. It's okay.
And I will just name, like, so I've known Micah for a couple of years now. We're friends. We host generally Pride together every year when we are in person. We do Beloved and Proud and Judson and the Park, do a lot of things together. But I've also found your prayers really helpful for people in my life that I can send them to, especially people that didn't know how to pray for lots of different reasons, because there's a lot going on and there's a lot to life. And what I found really helpful about your prayers, in part because they're helpful writ large, but is that they do take something small and say, here, this is for you, or this is for us. And this is one little thing that we're doing together. But they cover the expansiveness of the experience that we were having together, of who we were together, who we are together. And so, as I think about that, I am really grateful that you came on or are here to talk about David Byrne, who also has such an expansive catalog and who also does things really well, but also in his own way says, here's something specific that we're looking into. So why David Byrne? You and I went back and forth on some things to talk about. Mm-hmm. Talk to us a little bit about David Byrne and why.
I'm so excited, and I'm trying to like figure out how not to just follow the ecstatic enthusiasm that I have, just like that could go in 25 directions. So,
the dopamine.
Why David Byrne? I mean, I believe that David Byrne not only is a musician and an artist to admire because of his specific creations, but I also think that if we're talking about him through the lens of spirituality, that he is an example for me of someone who is interested in continually queering himself as he goes through the process of life. And for me, that is what I feel called to do as a faith leader, as an ordained person, as just somebody who is a member of congregations of faith. I feel like what we're being called to do is to continually queer ourselves. And what I mean when I say that is that you're being invited by the universe to continue to be curious about your life, to continue to step outside of the binaries and the boxes that our society desperately tries to put us into, and you're being called to move more toward a horizon that I might call the kingdom of God, a horizon that we're never gonna totally get to in our lifetimes, but that it's well worth getting to. And that to me is the definition of kind of becoming a queer person. I don't technically usually like to say that I am queer. I think that I am queering throughout all of my life. I don't think it's anything I'm ever going to get perfect at. And when it comes to David Byrne, I think in every lyric, in every bit of music that he puts there, in even the sound of his voice, you can hear that there is this continual yearning to get to some place, but a full understanding that you might not get there, but that the journey is still well worth it. And so I'm excited to unpack all that I just laid out.
We know where we're going, but we don't know where we've been.
Absolutely. And the way that he talks about that song,
little children, but we know what we want.
Yeah. You said it correctly. We know where we're going, but we don't know where we've been. And basically, when David Byrne, when he's asked to speak about his songs, everything that I've ever read, he kind of like says very pithy, very short things. So he kind of still just leaves it there for you to figure out yourself. But when asked about that song specifically, which is called Road to Nowhere, and those are among my favorite lyrics of his, he basically said, like, this is a song about doom and about being joyful as you acknowledge that we're headed toward doom. And instead of losing ourselves in kind of the anxiety that might cause in us, if we have an artist who's saying, like, we're headed toward doom, I do think that what he's saying there, you know, is in concert with what I just said, that there's this idea that if we're headed toward something bad, why not reach out for the people around you, find joy that can't be stolen by that threat of doom. And perhaps in the connection and the seeking of joy, we can actually figure out how to make this journey better for all of us. Go ahead.
Well, no. So I love that. And it's, Nothing But Flowers also kind of speaks to that. And mm-hmm. Nothing But Flowers, I was listening to on a flight from Wichita to Dallas, one way or the other. And I fell asleep and had the weirdest vivid dreams about Nothing But Flowers. But there is this idea of, okay, this is such a tangent, but it ties together. Get ready, deuces, it's time. So I'm really interested in gardening right now. And the people who seem to know the most about, like, gardening, like square foot vertical gardening, are doomsday preppers. And doomsday literature is kind of fascinating because they'll be like, this is how you build a easy, maintainable greenhouse. You just have to get through 50 pages of when the EMP is dropped by the Chinese to wipe out our infrastructure and we're all killing each other on the street. Make sure that your ammunition is stored near your bed. Like, it's the weirdest stuff in the world. And then it's, here's how to protect your gardener from, you know, hungry, or garden from hungry people who might need food. So if you ignore all of that, it becomes this beautiful thing of, what if it's, sorry, this is my mindset of, how about if I learn how to plant food and therefore we can build a sustainable community when society collapses? I love the doom joy dynamic, and that's mm-hmm. marvelous.
And you just kind of led into that, first of all, because I love what you just said, but it's that, so the doom joy dynamic, right? There's this idea that there's a binary there that is that they're opposites, that doom and joy can't possibly exist in the same space. And I think that at his best, what David Byrne was doing with the Talking Heads, but I would argue especially since he left the Talking Heads and started making music as a solo act, which he, you know, clearly has tons of collaborators on as well, is that he's always attempting to interrogate and dissolve binaries that we try to put between things. So I think, you know, as a person who is clearly incredibly intelligent and knowledgeable and is gaining more and more knowledge as he goes, he also continues to stay, like, more curious than probably any person I've ever encountered. I mean, I feel like the more knowledge you gain, the more you tend to kind of be pulled into thinking, like, well, I've learned everything there is to know. Now I just become an educator. And instead, he says, well, if I can learn this much, then I better stay more curious. So you stay a student. And I think that it is this intentional kind of approach to these binaries and interrogation and dissolving of them that really speaks to me through all of his music.
We promote a hermeneutic of curiosity on 2 on 1. So you're ringing our bell, most certainly.
David Byrne's ringing your bell.
Well, you are too, Micah.
I will admit, and I think, so Arthur's a fan. I don't know much. I think the very first, I mean, I know Talking Heads, but I wouldn't have been able to say, oh, that is also David Byrne. And I know American Utopia because I do theater and his name is in it. So that was where I was like, oh, are we doing specific American Utopia? And you're like, no, it's a lot more than that. And that's what, as I've done some research and, like, listened to the playlist you created for us, which has just been playing since you sent it to me, which is lovely. It is. It's that curiosity. And then I started looking at quotes, and he has this I mean, he has some incredible quotes, but one that I really liked at the end, he said, "The world isn't logical, it's a song." And I think that that's such a beautiful way in understanding his own, like, spiritual gifts, for lack of a better term, like his own place in the world and how those two marry together. Mm-hmm. And in that same vein, it's like, what is the song that we all know in our lives? What are those gifts? And mm-hmm. would we do better as a society to say, we're not looking for logic, we're looking for a continued path of curiosity. We're leaning into the gifts that we have that may not be what we think that they are. They may not even be what the world has told us that the world wants, but like, if we share them faithfully, then it becomes what the world needs.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I would say it's not even logic, it's profit. What if it's not about profit, but rather the song that is sung? Excuse me for jumping in on your point previously, Spiff.
No, it's not. And so I'm wondering for, you know, the two of you that are more knowledgeable of him and of his work, who are also faith leaders, where in our churches might we benefit, or faith communities, might we benefit from this kind of expansiveness in a way that, I don't know about y'all, when we have new people come in, you kind of hear what they do, hear what they like, and then you're like, oh, you latch onto the one thing, and then you're like, come do this one thing. But what David Byrne does is like, his one thing is to be curious, and whether that manifests in music or art or, you know, like visual presentations, performance, any sort of media, all of it, right, is that he navigates all of those spaces. So how, I'm going to rephrase this question, how do we as faith leaders invite that expansiveness from people that we have historically kind of singular said, here is your lane?
I love that question. And I think before I go to sort of answering that question for myself, I also want to kind of unpack and kind of interrogate even the word curiosity, because I think that sure. I think it is a word that I latch onto and adore, and it'll be said multiple times more over the course of the next little while. But I also think that what David Byrne at his best, and when I say at his best, I don't think any of us are always at our best, right? So I think it's important to say, like, we all make mistakes. And that, I think, is also something that I really admire about David Byrne, is that he, as opposed to other kind of famous people, celebrities, particularly male presenting, white presenting, heterosexual presenting people tend to double down when they're challenged with things. And I have only seen David Byrne basically respond to challenges by basically saying, like, I need to interrogate that more. And just to go to the word curiosity, you know, I think has moved toward this idea, and this is my own term, this is not his, so please don't put them in his mouth, because he might challenge it. But I think we also have to decolonize the idea of curiosity, because if we're being honest, particularly as white people, in a world where white supremacy has just kind of dominated and killed, our curiosity has killed people. Our curiosity has led to missions and crusades and ideas that we need to go in and act like we're curious, when actually what we're doing is bringing our dominance into a space and acting curious until we can be dominant over it.
I'm curious how you can conform to my ideals.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so I think, again, saying David Byrne at his best, I think David Byrne has been curious about music. I mean, I have my computer right now propped up on his book, How Music Works, which is a beautiful, brilliant, curious book. But he became quite fascinated with what's called world music in the industry, right? Which essentially is, I think, also a colonized term to kind of put an umbrella term over sounds from the rest of the world that isn't kind of the pop rock market in the US. But he started to curiously approach this music, and you hear it throughout everything that he does. But I would like to believe that what he's done is also not only co-opt sounds, but start to also queer himself and pay credence to the how those sounds are coming to him, how those sounds are being incorporated into the music that he's doing. And so I want to be clear that, like, you know, there's a way that curiosity has been and can be continued to be colonized, but decolonizing it means actual genuine curiosity. And to go back to your question, Stephanie, I would argue that what churches in my experience don't have is an authentic, genuine curiosity about those people who are coming in the door. You've got churches that are saying, like, well, how do we attract the LGBTQ community? And but I don't hear people basically going to the LGBTQ community and saying, what do you like? What are the things that you make? Why do you prefer to go to this thing instead of come to church? Why do you find your spirituality on the dance floor or at a book club or in a social justice organizing meeting instead of what we're making on Sunday morning? If you actually approach that with true curiosity and ask questions of the folks, then you might get answers that you haven't already preordained in your own mind. I think that white churches, my church in, you know, as an exhibit A, you know, there's this question of sort of like, why are we so white? Why don't people of color want to come to our service? And I feel like if churches started to actually interrogate the Eurocentric worship and theology that they are always leaning into and instead become decolonized, curious, you know, seekers of actually asking these communities where their spirituality is, where they're finding, you know, the spirit and what they want to bring to a space, then that curiosity could be turned into authentic relationship and authentic community. But unfortunately, I think that the churches that I've been a part of, and I'm interrogating myself. I mean, I've been a leader of one of these churches. That we're not quite yet ready to actually lean into that authentic relationship and authentic curiosity, because it would throw into question a lot of, you know, sacred things that we could do, you know, we could get rid of, but right now we're holding desperately to them.
And what I'm hearing, and I completely agree on this. Excuse me, Spiff.
No, please. No, I'm just like, that's a sermon. Just like pop that right up on the.
This is your fault because you've been wanting to get Micah and I together. So I don't want to overtalk, but and when I say congregational church, I'm talking white Eurocentric church is focused on was and sometimes will be, but it never is. What David Byrne does is he is. He's not was. He's not will be. He was on Saturday Night Live 2 years ago, I think, and he did Once in a Lifetime. And what fascinates me is when you trot out somebody who's maybe been doing the song for 30 years, or maybe it's the first time he did it since the Talking Heads ended. It just is in the moment. It's not any sort of callback. It's not any sort of projection. It's simply the performance as it happens. Mm-hmm. He was live in Austin, Texas, and it's my favorite album of his. And at the very end, the encore is he does "I Want to Dance with Somebody," and it's with strings and like four percussionists, and it's David Byrne singing "I Want to Dance with Somebody," and he's tired, and he doesn't hit every note. And it's just the song. The statement is that it's simply the statement that is. And what we do in the church so often is that we have to honor this liturgy was set in 1978, and therefore we can only diverge from it briefly. Or we have not decolonized our understanding of whiteness, our understanding of power, our understanding of leadership in any way that's formative or useful, because whatever we will be is such an indescribable and unobtainable thing. You know, he was on an episode of The Simpsons, right, as The Simpsons were going right off the board. Have you seen this one, Micah?
I have not. I've seen the screen cap of like of him on it, but I've never seen the
episode. So Homer, I think it's like season 8 or season 9. It's right as the Golden Age was ending. Homer writes a song about how everybody hates Ned Flanders, and he's just playing it in a bar, and it's just dumb and lovely. And David Byrne walks in and he says, I was passing by doing anthropological research on the folk songs of Springfield, and I couldn't help but hear your delightful little hate song, and I'd like to produce it. And what happens is it becomes a huge commercial success. And then David Byrne is like, now we're doing it. David Byrne is like, we're doing the Spanish version. And look, you haven't heard this cover. And he's just satirizing his life as a slightly successful, actually very successful, non-commercial, commercialized art. It's fascinating because it's only about David Byrne in that like 1 month of his life. And that's it. It's David Byrne is, and therefore he cannot be defined. And I wish the church would do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I love that. I do. I mean, I think that's right. Right. All of those things, we need to decolonize curiosity 1000%. What do we think? Why we think it, and why do we think it's best? And just all of that. And as you were talking and all the iterations again of what it means to be curious about who people are and what people do, one of the things that I was like looking up, literally just like I Googled David Byrne, right? What pops up first is always generally like where I start. And there are these images of him that have reformed, informed his body. Like he has shaped his body in different ways. Like physically, he physically changes the look of him. And he's got these big shoulders and like makes these very angular, like kind of like visual spaces of him to tell a different story than maybe what is happening in a softer song. I don't know why or what. That's part of, I guess, my own curiosity around that. But I think it has made me curious about this as a question for us all is when we put together worship, and Micah, you named this earlier, like in the pandemic, we were like, let's keep worship going. We need online worship to look just like regular worship. And here's this thing that we're pushing out and making sure that people feel and see and all the things that are, kind of a tenor to what was, instead of saying, okay, like maybe you're going to get a Zoom prayer because that's what is. But one of the things I noticed that a lot of faith communities did was try and make it look the same. Maybe it's a green screen. Maybe it's just your own clergy garb. And David Byrne calls us into something else. How can the church benefit? How have you seen it done well? Where are we curious that might go in the physicality of who we are as faith leaders and possibly the worship writ large? How do we change the look?
Wow. That's a big question. I want to make sure that I start to sort of formulate an answer. You stop me if I am misunderstanding the question.
Because I have a specific thought about a particular worship and group of people that Judson collaborates with in liturgy and worship well. And that was where in my head I thought I was going.
Love it.
Ask an Arthur question. I just want to point that out, listeners. That
just did ask an Arthur question.
Making a thought and a question, and it just kind of landed flat. And she does it sometimes too.
I will not say that landed flat. It like invited me into a space of being like, this is such a good question. I need this to be a good answer. Which actually, if we're actually queering ourselves in this conversation, that is actually not true. So any answer is going to be appropriate to this. So, but thank you for guiding us into that, because I was going there as well. And so we're right there. I mean, what I think could benefit church in terms of look, experience, liturgy, the entire, shebang is to be inviting artists and organizers into their spaces. And not only, either renting space to them or giving them space, but also trying to create radical relationship with them so that they are changing your liturgical life on Sunday mornings or whenever you worship. you know, and I realize, as I say, Sunday morning, that that's making it specifically Christian. Like, I think that all faith communities could actually benefit from bringing artists and organizers into their space. You know, I've run a program at Judson since like 2010, and have had various wonderful collaborators with it. But it's Judson Arts, and we essentially have had every week on Wednesday, a full meal is prepared and served at 7 o'clock. And then at 8 o'clock, something creative happens. Oftentimes the art is in like a very early developmental stage. And so it is this beautiful burst of creativity that by design probably fails in countless ways in that moment. But what we're trying to bring people into is acknowledging that instead of thinking of what church has to offer as this product that has to be perfect and given to, you know, the spirit of the congregation there, and instead of thinking of art as this perfect product that needs to be commodified and presented and without flaw, we want to create an intentionally sacred space where we are saying, you know what? The prophets of old that we understand were performance artists. Yes, they were social justice folks as well. They were arguing for change and for reformation, but they were also trying to ask questions that just shook the foundations enough that change was possible. They, to do a version of what you were talking about, Arthur, you know, we like to say at Judson that artists have the potential to serve as our modern day prophets. They show us where we've been, they show us who we are, and they show us what we can become. And so we like to think that every time we have artists in our space, there's the potential for new prophecy to be filling the air of that space. And so what would happen if you brought those artists into, you know, your worship service, and instead of said like, okay, Here's the boundaries you have to be in. The song has to be, you know, it has to be either a traditional worship song, or it has to be, you know, it has to be kind of fit into our ideas of what worship is.
It has to be to the tune of Holy Manna. Yeah,
absolutely. Do what you do. Bring the art that you do into the space.
Because we focus so much on was. And I was comfortable last week because it was what is familiar and what is comfortable. And both of those things are important in worship, but also there's no space for is if all we do is, you won't learn David Byrne by listening to the greatest hits. Mm-hmm. You will absolutely enjoy yourself, but you won't learn him unless you is with him or you are with him for the sake of it. And by the way, Micah, some other time when we're not on the air, I want to talk to you about my brilliant idea about communal improvisational preaching. Because it's going to be insane and probably won't work. Okay.
Good.
You're talking about liminal space in this, because liminal space is just that which is between two points. You sent the lyric from a long time ago, in between stations, I can hear a million possibilities. Mm. And I think we have that with art. I think we have that with this authentic and transparent community. How do we embrace liminal space? Because that's literally all the church is in right now. Even if churches are back to meeting in person, they've discovered like you're going to be lucky to have 60% of your numbers. Mm-hmm. And your young families have been like, oh shit, we can eat waffles and watch church on the couch and not get the kids ready. They're not coming back. So how do we move out of liminal space is what we have to get through to liminal space is what we have to live in?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I would argue that you have beautifully answered your own question, because I think.
Thank you. I also do that every episode. I'll be bringing up the Apostle Paul shortly, listeners.
But I mean it sincerely when I say, I think how does church embrace liminal space? It embraces it because I think that church is very actually uncomfortable with embracing liminal space. I mean, I have an amazing congregation that I'm really blessed to lead at Judson, you know, and we are in a moment of transition, not only the transition that everybody is going through clearly, and goes through, I think, just by waking up in the morning and being like, wow, I have a chance to try this again. But I also think that We're in a moment of transition because our senior minister, who was there for 15 years, recently left. And so we are in a transition mode leading up to a search for a new senior minister and or a new way of thinking about a model for ministry. We're working with a transition minister who has brought wonderful questions to us. And I'm trying, as somebody who's been at Judson for a while, to build what I'm calling an inquisitive inventory, to basically give questions to the congregation about transition every time I go up to preach now. So we're building these questions that I would argue are about being in liminal space. And so I think of the first question that we believe, you know, God asked in our sacred scripture, which was Aika, you know, where are you? Meaning like, not like, where are you physically? Where is your heart? Where is your spirit? You need to name it. And that goes to the is, I think, that you're talking about, Arthur, that where, don't name where you've been, don't name where you're going right now, name where you are right now. So where are you? Where do you want to go? Who do you need in order to get there? Then, while you're in the midst of that whirlwind naming those things, look around you. When was the last time you looked and said, wow? Because I think that we oftentimes are not able to just be in that present moment and look at how, if you decenter yourself and look at the entire universe that not only is all around you, but has been going on for so long before you existed
and will survive after you.
Absolutely. Will definitely exist later. Like then suddenly I think that you're called into an interdependent participation that you can oftentimes turn away from. And then yesterday I added the question, like, when was the last time you stopped to breathe? Because I think oftentimes we go through our life and we've got this reciprocal circular breath that's always going on, right? And we don't pay attention to. And yes, we have self-care, we have meditation. I think that mindfulness is getting more and more into our culture in this way of like, you need to focus on your breath. But like with all of those things, when was the last time you stopped to breathe when you weren't in a place where they were telling you to do it? When you weren't in a place like where your minister said, okay, we're going to breathe together. When was the last time you actually stepped back, stopped thinking that all of this was on your shoulders, that had a little humility, and stopped and said no to predatory capitalism and white supremacy and said, I'm actually going to breathe right now. I am going to breathe because
Pharaoh wants you to breathe while you turn bricks into, or straw into bricks. That's fine.
Totally.
I know you got one. I can see that look in your face.
No, I was just, I love the question, was that you stopped to breathe, because one, it's such a pivotal question for this time in our lives. It's someone who has had COVID, it's someone, speaking to you, Manga, but like, or, you know, all of our people, all we hear about is that you can't breathe, right? That's one of the main symptoms of this pandemic and of this past year, and what does it look like, and of global warming and all, you know, or in climate change and all of that. And then we had an author come on who kicked off our New Year's show, and she has a book called 12 Tiny Things. And she reminded us, like, or she asked the question, when was the last time you looked up? Like, when was the last time you went outside and just like looked up? And I think it does that same invitation into the curious wonders of the world. And I wonder, as my kind of last question, do either of your communities celebrate Holy Saturday? And what might we gain by giving more, using the lens of David Byrne's invitation to kind of sit in the liminality of who we are as people? What might we gain in faith communities to give more authority to maybe that day, or maybe authority is the wrong word, but like presence to that day? Mm-hmm. As someone who are people of the resurrection who often say we need to spend more time in Good Friday. What does it look like for us to really say, and here's this day of wonder?
Oh, Stephanie, I love that question. So I will probably very messily answer this, but that's on brand.
Welcome to the show.
First, I mean, I preached on Easter Sunday, for the first time, probably in maybe 2014 or 2015. And the theme that I chose was sort of this liminal space, this idea of Holy Saturday. And though I certainly think that there are probably lots of folks that would argue against and challenge what I'm about to say, I think there's power in thinking that we are still in Holy Saturday, and that the resurrection that we might be able to lean into is suggested to me by that original ending of the Gospel according to Mark, before they kind of tacked on another ending to nudge it more toward a certain kind of resurrection, that instead there's power in staying in Holy Saturday, letting it drift then into Sunday, and saying, what are the ways that this community resurrected itself and resurrected their leader's lessons following his execution by empire? And I would argue that a symbol for me there is that they took the wood of the cross and they reshaped it into the wood of a table. And basically they said, here's the symbol of empire. Here's the thing that our leader was hanged upon. Let's take that and dismantle it. And now that our leader has been executed, it is our role to always be coming to this table, to always be telling the story of this person and of the community around whom, you know, that gathered around him. And it's our job to make sure that all are welcome at this table, to remember this story, to tell the story, and to keep the good news of this gospel going. So I would say that to me is the powerful potential for faith communities, is to say, I don't think it's a negation of faith to stay in that liminal space. In fact, I think it's the definition of faith to stay in that liminal space. And I'm not trying to dismantle anybody's, you know, theology around Christ's resurrection. But what I am saying about myself, both as a person of faith and a leader of faith, is that ultimately, I don't know that the historicity of that event defines my faith. The liminal space of Holy Saturday defines my faith.
Amen. Arthur?
I'm a seven serving a very traditional community. Hell no, we don't go to Holy Saturday. So we are cognizant of the time, and we want to make sure that we keep up our streak of asking the same final question to all of our friends and associates and interviewees and people. Spiff does it so much more soundly than I. And I'm just the timekeeper.
You're much more than the timekeeper. But Micah, thank you so much for coming on. This was exceptional. It was things that I think I even needed just to hear. And it's good to see you. We keep saying, let's get together. So at least we got to do this together. And thank you for bringing David Byrne to the conversation. I think it's when you're like, he's a prophet for our time and all those things, I was like, okay, can't wait to hear this. And I fully agree. I'm a convert. I'm here for it. I'm really excited. So what biblical theme, narrative, scripture, verse, person, anything are you most reminded of by David Byrne?
I've been thinking about this a lot. And I'm going to do what I told myself I wasn't going to do, which is basically say, like, I feel like I have a fear that it's going to feel so easy to say what I'm about to say, but it's just what is really on my heart. But, you know, clearly my name is Micah. I was supposed to be named Jonah or Noah, but there's a whole legend and mythology in my family about why I ended up with the name Micah. But, you know, the prophet Micah has been very important to me as I was growing up, and especially as I hated my name as a youngster, because growing up in like 1980s Ohio with the name Micah before the name kind of caught on, that was not a pretty scene. But
I have tons of sympathy for you. I really do.
I understand. Well, we'll have a whole other episode about that.
Why did our parents name us this? That's a great episode.
But I feel like the, you know, Micah 6:8. I feel like is my favorite section of scripture. I think it is so simple and so complicated. And in, you know, in the spirit of saying that we're interrogating and dissolving binaries through the work of David Byrne, I think that holding those two things in tension and not thinking of them as separate, but thinking simple and complicated are, you know, they go hand in hand. That's what I think of when I think of David Byrne. You know, and if folks need the reminder, you know, it's Micah 6:8 is God has told you, O mortal, what is good, and what does God require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God. And I feel like that's my holy trinity right there. Mm. It's do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with your God. And so do, love, and be humble. What are the other things that you're asked to do? And I feel like I watch David Byrne and I listen and hear David Byrne interrogating his own assumptions, interrogating his own past. As Arthur said, you know, being in the present moment and what is, and saying, what is the next step toward justice that I can make? What is the next step toward loving kindness that I can make? And how can I always do this with humility? And I think that's a challenge and an invitation for all of us all the time.
Amen. Arthur?
All right. I'm finally going to do it. I'm going to go for the Apostle Paul with caveats here. Number one, I'm reminded of 1 Corinthians 1. The message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to those who are being saved, it is the power of God. Because it's not a dichotomy. It sounds like a dichotomy. It sounds like an either or, but it's not. It's a very slippery stretch of ground. It's also that matter of there's always Gentiles. No matter how much one does or one goes to, there's always going to be something else that is, that has to inform, that provokes change. And if we are decolonizing the faith, we do so by saying, you know, okay, this is the unknown God. This is how I interpret it, but tell me yours. This is Philippi, isn't Corinth, isn't Thessaloniki. It's the Apostle Paul without all of the baggage he so rightfully deserves piled on top of him.
I love it.
I'm in.
I'm in too. I've been thinking, I've been like, do I change my answer? Because I've been thinking about this all week too, of like, what do I do? Because I didn't know David Byrne as well as, you know, others. But I'm going to stick with my original answer, because I think our conversation has solidified it for me. And I'm going to go with John 1:1, that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God, because it is more than what it seems to be. And David Byrne has a quote, and the things I was looking at, about how, the inadequacy of language, and how all things are much more than what they seem to be. And so for me, I'm going to go with that in the John 1, that we have in the beginning was the Word. It is God. It was God. It will be God. And it's so much more. And so, and that is, yes.
Okay. My answer was going to be John 1:1, because logo better translated as the conversation as opposed to the Word, and conversations have to be active. Otherwise they're just lectures or their final ordination interviews, which this most certainly was not. Micah Busey, thank you so very much for joining us on 2 on 1 today. Micah has just authored and published the Book of Tiny Prayer. It's Spiff is holding it. You can get your own copy by going to a variety of sellers. We encourage you to talk to your independent local booksellers, because they can order it just as well as you can on a certain enormous website that doesn't need your money anymore. Micah, thank you 1,000 times for being here. You know, if this is paradise, I wish I had a lawnmower. We're sponsored by Jeff Wonrow Designs. Check him out at Jeff Wonrow, JeffWunrow.com. Don't forget our promo code 2on1 for 15% off your entire Stoll order. I'm telling you that specifically, Micah, but really all of our deuces. And this has been the show. I'm the Reverend Arthur Stewart.
I'm the Reverend Stephanie Kendall.
And we will see you next time. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.